Where else can you choose from over 300 miles of epic single track against a backdrop of soaring mountains and cascading waterfalls? And where else can you explore 100,000 acres of public lands laced with hundreds of miles of backcountry gravel roads? Your best mountain biking adventure ever begins in Brevard, North Carolina, home to Pisgah National Forest and DuPont State Recreational Forest. Four primo bike shops will get you sorted, whether you need a rental, service, or some cool swag. Top it off with an array of craft breweries, cafes, and gathering spots that have earned Brevard the title as one of America's coolest small towns. It all adds up to one of the premier mountain biking destinations in the U.S. Find out more at explorebrevard.com. Hey everybody, welcome to the Single Tracks Podcast. My name is Jeff, and today Matt and I are going to be talking about mountain bike weights. And love it or hate it, mountain bikes aren't as lightweight as they used to be. And, you know, this is something we've been talking about a little bit, writing about, and so thought it'd be fun to dive in and talk about it. But before we do, I would just want to make a note that this will be Matt's last podcast with us. He's moving on at the end of the month here. And so before we dive in, I just wanted to like kind of take a second and look back on some of the contributions Matt's made over the years. You know, Matt, you joined us, I believe, in June of 2018. Is that right?
Yeah, it was about that. May or June, I believe. Yeah. Yeah, so it's been almost 6 years now.
Yeah, crazy. And so, yeah, like going back, I mean, you've written a ton for the site. And over those years, like, I mean, literally hundreds of articles, maybe 1,000. I don't know. I should have counted.
It's over 1,000. Yeah, maybe 1,100 now.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, crazy. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, it's impossible to go back and read every one of them. But I do want to highlight some of the ones that really come to mind for me. One of them was an article in, I think it was like 2022-ish, an article about the bike boom and kind of the end of the pandemic-induced bike boom. You were one of the first to sort of write about that. And, you know, a lot of people thought that this like crazy demand for bikes was going to keep going, but you actually did a really great job like interviewing people and looking at it and actually coming away with like a different conclusion.
Yeah, I think it's the same one I'm thinking of. I remember talking to at least some bike shops at that time who had, you know, been thrown into the mix and were still expected to keep orders that they had placed like during the height of the pandemic, and just seeing the interest for like those orders basically evaporate. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I feel like the bike shops were kind of the first ones to really see like this bike boom falling out from under them, which, yeah, we all know now is the industry as a whole is not doing well and definitely fell into that trend. But yeah, that I do remember that one being a big one and just getting a lot of way more reads and interest than I think well beyond our general mountain bike audience.
Right. Yeah. And it wasn't like it's definitely I don't want to say unpopular, but it was not like an accepted point of view at that time. Like, again, everybody thought for sure, like, oh, this boom is going to last. We've got orders backed up for years and years. And yeah, you really were kind of courageous to call that out and be like, no, like this, that may not be happening here.
Yeah. I don't know if it was maybe like veiled optimism from a lot of the brands who are like, oh no, I think we're going to keep this large percentage of people who picked up riding or mountain biking.
Yeah.
Cycling in their neighborhoods after the pandemic. But, you know, once like baseball games and bars and everything like that, movie theaters open back up, you know, I mean, hopefully some people are still out there riding, but
yeah, there's a few. Yeah.
Obviously like the bicycle. Yeah. The bicycle was just such like a great thing to have during the pandemic. There were some other industries and like maybe pieces of like outdoor gear equipment that sort of like follow the trend of the bike. But I don't think there's any one piece that really like made the heights of the bicycle during the pandemic.
Yeah. This article too, I mean, it really illustrates that like you as a journalist, I mean, you try to be independent as much as possible and not necessarily, I mean, obviously we have lots of connections with brands and PR people and we're being fed certain, you know, stories and different trends that are going on. But Yeah. I mean, you obviously have been really good at like looking through that and kind of figuring it out on your own and seeing like, hey, is this true? Like the brands are saying we got all this demand, but yeah, you're willing to figure out if that is the case.
Yeah. I mean, I came from, well, this was like journalism was a, I don't know, third or fourth career or something like that for me. But yeah, I went to journalism school and just still felt really, really strongly about like the education that my professors and like the influence that they had on me of just being independent and like do it for your readers and no one else. That is, I mean, still a very big guiding principle for a lot of my writing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, and you've definitely left your mark, I think, on Single Tracks as a publication with that point of view. Another one of your articles that's not so serious but was also extremely popular was a commentary on a Toyota marketing campaign.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember this one, but Toyota had a campaign where they were, you know, obviously they're trying to sell a car, but they had this guy in the picture that just looked ridiculous. He had a crazy like downhill outfit, but he was like standing next to this, you know, 100 mil travel, maybe bike with reflectors on it. And it didn't seem to fit. And that one literally broke the website. Like I remember, it was like in the summer, I don't remember what summer, but it was in the summertime and like, I was not home. I was like working remotely and yeah, trying to get the website back up. I'm like, oh my gosh, like why are so many people clicking this? But yeah, right. that was another really, really fun one. Like, how did you come across that?
Well, they were getting, originally Toyota had posted the image to its Instagram and they were just getting trashed by like mountain bikers and mountain bike influencers and stuff like that in the comment section. And so, you know, obviously this isn't like peak news or anything like that, not hard hitting news, but just being like this small independent mountain bike website with like cultural takes and stuff like that, like it gives us room to comment on it. And so, yeah, I kind of turned it into a news article in the sense that like Toyota, you know, tried to appeal to mountain bikers by like having this guy or gal, whoever it was, like basically clad in this, it almost looks like a dirt bike kit. Like it is a...
Yeah, it's head to toe. Yeah, you couldn't tell. You couldn't even tell if it was man or woman.
And then, I mean, they're like towering over this, like, it looks like a Walmart bike, to be honest.
Yeah, but it was all black. I just re-looked at it and was like, okay, maybe they were just like trying to hide what kind of bike it was so that, you know, it wasn't distracting.
Yeah, I'm sure they probably just like took a can of spray paint and went straight over the frame and stuff.
That's probably right.
But and the other fun thing is like I own a 4Runner. Many of my friends own 4Runners or Tacomas or Tundras. It's like, that's just obviously a hugely popular brand with mountain bikers. And so, it's fun to poke fun at them from the perspective of like, mountain bikers don't really need to be in your ads to love your vehicles. You're doing a good enough job by building good ones anyway, but
yeah,
your marketing department kind of botched it on this one. So
yeah. Yeah. Did you ever hear from anybody at the brand or anything?
No, they came out with like follow-up ads or something like that afterwards. And we're like, it's something like the gloves are off now, or that there is like the kickstand is off. Training wheels are off now, something like that. And they posted, you know, like a more authentic looking mountain biker. They still had ankle socks. That was the one thing that stood out to me. It's like, well, you're almost there. But maybe I'm just picky about socks. I don't know.
That's funny. Well, another series of articles that you did looked at wildfires in the West in particular and sort of how that impacts mountain biking. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily like mountain bike specific. Obviously, that affects a lot of things from recreation, including wildlife and, you know, people's homes. And I mean, it's a huge topic.
Yeah.
But clearly you're passionate about it and did a great job like researching it. And I know I learned a ton from those articles and I think our readers really appreciated them as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, there was a ton of research. And if you live in the West or even like in the East last year with all the smoke coming down from Canada, but particularly if you live in the West, like you're dealing with some trail related impact from wildfires, whether it's like it's too smoky to have an enjoyable ride, or forest that you're trying to ride in is closed because there's a massive fire, or it's like a year or two later. And in our case in Colorado, like it's a year or two after the fire has come and gone that you get rainstorms and then just erosion and all these things that have a big impact on the trail. So learning about like forest fires and forest conservation and just forest health is still really, really fascinating to me, because it is this, I mean, obviously it's an ecosystem, but it's this little economy of all these parts that work together. And a lot of factors that are still really surprising and interesting to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested to know, like, what were your favorite stories to cover, or were there specific stories, or maybe just like certain topics that you enjoyed the most?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there's a big part of me, because I have that, like, I don't know if I'd call it old school, but rigid standard of like journalism influence on my work, that I do love doing like the trail access reporting. So the stuff we did in, well, stuff I reported on in Colorado that was after the pandemic as well, the population booms and some of the land managers and their really, really conservative ways of dealing with mountain bike access on the Front Range in Colorado, and how mountain biking has kind of evolved past some of those ways of management. That was one of my favorites. The reporting we did in Copper Harbor after some of the trail closures out there. That was great, just because there are so many different stakeholders to talk to, and you kind of look at this like, here's what's going on, why is the trail closed, local governments being kind of at risk of being sued, even though they, you know, if you talk to lawyers and stuff like that, they weren't necessarily at risk. But then, hey, like, is this going to have an effect on the economy, on tourism? I just like digging into those stories and having like pages and pages of research and trying to figure out how to weave it all together. There's a recent one on hunting groups and their opposition to mountain bike trails in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, I wrote in December. And yeah, that one was interesting to tackle, because I'm a new hunter as well. And so seeing the values that hunting groups have and how that interferes with, you know, potential new mountain bike trails is just, a clash of ideals for public land, which everybody is entitled to in some aspect. But I think like my favorite thing, honestly, was just being in a publication where I can write about like almost anything as long as it's related to mountain biking. So there's a number of essays that that I wrote, and that honestly, like, I feel like I got the most valuable or the most heartfelt of reader feedback, where I'd get a lot of personal emails like thanking me for something I wrote, which is always nice, you know. And for other writers and stuff, like if you're willing to open yourself up and like be vulnerable to an audience, the audience generally returns the favor, you know, very greatly.
Yeah.
People appreciate that kind of writing, and that's what made me want to be a writer. So just having like essays, opinion pieces that, connected with readers, reporting pieces that connected with readers, gear reviews. I mean, I've done like so many bike reviews that they feel fairly formulaic to kind of like churn out, but every once in a while, you know, you'll just kind of hit the nail on the head and a review will do really well. Or you'll review like kind of something a little oddball, like a high pivot bike or an internal, I guess high pivots aren't really oddball anymore, but internally geared bikes. Occasionally we have reviews that, that a lot of people read and have feedback on and stuff like that. So yeah, I would just say like having the ability to write just a multitude of different types of articles, from essays, opinions, reviews, reporting, and having the ability to like connect with readers on every type of writing was my favorite. There's a lot of digital mountain bike publications out there that solely focus on gear, and I think I would have gone crazy if I was in that position. So
I mean, you offer great advice for any writer, really, in terms of like being open and honest and vulnerable sometimes. And yeah, hopefully this is something too that your replacement is listening to and is like, okay, they'll be able to pick up the torch and carry it on. What can you share with us about what you're moving on to next?
Yeah, so I am accepted a technical writing job with the Federal Aviation Administration. So it's seems like a pretty big jump from what I'm doing right now, and it definitely is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would add that, like, as you know, and you know, I come from I'm a military veteran, mm-hmm. and so I've had a lot of friends who are also vets who make their way into the federal government, because if you are a vet, there are pathways to get into the federal government that sort of lower the barrier to entry, and the federal government's just notoriously difficult to get into. So it's a different change of pace for me and my wife trying to start a family. It'll be a really solid foundation for us to have. So
yeah,
I'm excited about it. And yeah, I'm planning to continue freelancing as long as you guys will have me.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm looking forward to as much as I love mountain biking, as big of a part of my life as it's been, you know, it'll be nice not to have it consume my life anymore for now. So
that makes sense. Yeah. Well, we'll certainly miss you. And like I said, though, I mean, your contributions will be felt here for a long time for sure. And yeah, we're looking forward to having you come back every now and then and share your words with us.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, it's been a dream when I was, I guess this is like 8 years ago now, and was just like, yeah, I'm going to give this journalism thing a shot. And it was at the time of, like, you know, I was going through school, and a lot of my professors who are, you know, hardcore newspaper journalists and magazine journalists, and we were kind of watching the Denver Post fall apart and get acquired by private equity firms and just gutted. And that was happening at every major newspaper across the country. Mm-hmm. And so it was a long shot for me to get any sort of, like, full-time journalism job out of school. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think if, you know, looking back, I would have loved to get into some sort of, like, newspaper job back then. But the way things worked out with single tracks, yeah, it's still, I guess it's not surprising if you look at the way that Single Tracks is managed as an independent publication, but it is great to see it doing well in a, when many, many publications are not. Yeah. So I think that speaks to, like, independent journalism and, yeah, just smart management. So I'm really fortunate to have put in 6 years, like, in this kind of dream job as a mountain bike journalist and editor. Yeah, I'm super grateful for the experience.
Awesome. Well put. Well, we are here to also talk about mountain bike weights. Hopefully there's lots to say about it. So I guess I should back up. Like, are mountain bikes getting heavier? Like, is this something you've noticed in the last 6 years or so?
Yeah, I think I would say it's a generalization, but I would say overall, it's probably true.
Yeah, I was trying to come up with examples. I mean, I'm an engineer by education. And so, yeah, mm-hmm. I always, like, my first inclination is like, well, what does the data say? And, you know, honestly, I don't have a lot of great data. I guess I could. It would take some work. We could go back and look.
Yeah, it would take
bike weights. Yeah, right. Bunch of old musty catalogs. But I did notice. So back in 2012, I had a Santa Cruz Tallboy. 29er bike carbon, mm-hmm. That I built up myself. And it wasn't like a crazy, like, weight weenie build by any means. It was a build using, like, pretty reasonable parts that I had laying around. And from what I saw, that bike weighed 27 pounds once it was all
built light.
Up. Yeah. Which today that is very light.
Yeah.
At the time, it, like I said, it wasn't like a weight weenie build or anything. And then looking to, like, comparing that to a bike I have now, I have a hardtail that weighs 32 pounds, like 5 pounds more, which is kind of crazy.
That's a heavy bike.
Yeah.
A heavy hardtail.
Yeah, that's true. For a hardtail, it is a lot. But also, again, I mean, to me, the build is pretty average. It's not like I didn't put, you know, inserts and, like, the heaviest enduro tires I could get. Like, that's all with, like, trail bikey stuff. So yeah. What about your bikes? Like, what are the kind of weights are you looking at with yours?
Yeah, good question. I'll start with my gravel bike, which the weight fluctuates on that one mostly, I'd say, because, you know, sometimes I'll have narrower, lighter tires on there because I'm just riding road on it. And then, yeah, last fall when I was doing a bike packing trip, I threw on, I mean, basically old mountain bike tires, like they're just under 2 inches, added a suspension fork, and I guess that's mostly it, gear wise. But yeah, it probably ranges from maybe 20 to 23 pounds.
Wow.
Maybe 20 at its lightest to, yeah, 23 pounds is pretty heavy for a drop bar bike, but definitely not the heaviest out there. And then I've got an Ibis Ripley AF trail bike. That's an aluminum, 120 mil bike. And that one, I think right now is probably 31, if it's not 32 pounds. So somewhere right in there.
Okay. Yeah.
And for that bike, it's like, it's a 120 mil bike. So it pedals really, really well. And of course it's got a DW link. So that makes it pedal even better. So just being that it's a cross country bike, it pedals really well, but I mean, obviously there are a lot of other 120 mil travel bikes that are quite a bit lighter than that by probably a couple pounds.
Or heavier too, though. I mean,
yeah,
there's kind of a range. I mean, do you think there is, in your mind, is there like a cutoff where you're like, if it's above this, it's heavy. If it's below that, it's light.
I think it depends on the bike for me. Hmm. Yeah. So my other bike is a Canfield Lithium. It's a 163 mil travel bike. And so you obviously know it's going to be heavier than any other bike that I own. Last summer it was weighing over 35, and that was with aluminum rims. And then I threw carbon wheels on there, swapped out some tires. I'm wondering, I have a new review fork that I need to throw on there, and I don't know how much of a weight difference that's going to make, but I've also got a Fox 38 with like this extra air can Vorsprung Cicus thing on there that adds a little bit of weight, but obviously it's just a super heavy fork. It's like more than 5 pounds. And so I've got it down under 35 now. And I think under 35 for a big 163 millimeter travel bike is pretty decent.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, that's a big range though, like a few pounds, I guess. Yeah, I don't know what the percentage is offhand, but yeah, to go from like a shorter travel to a longer travel. I mean, in a lot of ways, like you're not adding a lot in terms of like the suspension stuff, but everything does get built up like more sturdily, I guess. And yeah, you mentioned with all of these bikes, like the tires making a huge difference. And that definitely seems to be an area where a lot of bikes are gaining weight, at least from what I've seen.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say like to your point of bikes getting heavier over the years, like the trend that really backs that up is, I don't know when it started happening, at least like late 2010s. Yeah, definitely late 2010s, of where pretty much every bike, as long as it wasn't a cross country bike, was getting overbuilt by product managers. It's like, you know, for a trail bike, oh, why are we putting a Fox 34 and we could put a Fox 36, or, you know, why put Maxxis Ardents when you could put DHRs. And even now with, on the same topic of like suspension, there's a lot of bikes that used to, like the Rocky Mountain Instinct I have in for test right now, that bike used to come with just an inline Fox DPS shock. And now it's got a Fox Float X shock with the reservoir on it. So just little choices like that, which are super common in the mountain bike industry, just add up to more weight over time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and you make a good point too, that this isn't like, I mean, it's never going to be driven by the brands. I mean, they're just responding to what consumers are telling them, which is like, yeah, I would like a bigger fork. If I could get a 36 on that bike instead of a 34, I'm going to buy that. And yeah, you also hit it too, in terms of like, you know, all of these things, these are like a lot of little decisions, and everything adds like a little bit more weight, but you know, if you add them all up, like it becomes pretty significant. And so, yeah, it's definitely like has kind of creeped up. And, you know, I'm same way. Like I would say before, even like if you asked me 5 or 10 years ago, I would have said like, oh yeah, I like a lightweight bike. I want it as light as possible. But even I've said many times like, oh yeah, I'll take a little extra weight for that. And little bit for that. And it's like, yep. Whoa, how did this happen? Well, it's like all these little decisions and little upgrades that you make over time.
Yeah. Look at, was it last week, your article on what happened to all the mechanicals?
Yeah.
There's probably a good correlation with that, as far as like bike weights creeping up.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and a few more examples for me too. Like I kind of think, and I tend to mostly just ride and think about trail bikes, like anything from like 120 to 140 millimeter travel bikes. But like a couple of the recent ones I've reviewed, the weights have been closer to like 35 pounds. And
yeah,
for me, like, I would say my cutoff for a bike like that, like 120 to 140, I would say like 30 pounds seems like it should be a good goal, but mm-hmm. I haven't tested a sub 30 pound bike in a while. So
yeah.
And 30, I mean, again, it's like, it's a round number. So it's probably not the exact number, but yeah. Where did all the 30 pound bikes go?
The bike I had, before the Canfield, which was just kind of a single tracks test mule that Drew had for a little while, was the Privateer 161. Mm-hmm. And when I had it, Drew might have had it even heavier because I know he likes to do tire inserts and all that stuff. Oh, and a coil shock too. And I ended up putting an air can on it just because it was lighter. But even with an air can and a reasonably not overbuilt enduro bike built, that bike was north of 36 pounds. It had a super firm suspension kinematics to it, a very firm pedaling platform. So it makes it more enjoyable. But even still, you know, if you're talking about the difference between like an 8 mile after work ride and like a 20 mile backcountry ride on the weekend, like that weight adds up to a lot of fatigue over the day.
Yeah.
So.
Definitely. Yeah. And, you know, another one of the bikes that kind of surprised me was the Evil, the Following, which that bike rides so well. And I had so much fun testing it. But it's, I mean, it's, I believe they call it a downcountry bike. I would agree. It's a, that style of bike. It weighs 32 pounds and it costs $7,000. So like you would think a bike that is designed to be like really capable of climbing would be, I would hope would be lighter weight than that. But yeah, it turns out that it's not.
Yeah. And I guess it depends. Maybe it depends on if you look at the brand, like Evil, I always think of like, okay, these are gravity oriented bikes. They're bikes that they might have like a shorter travel option, like the Following, but really that brand's ethos is downhill. Mm-hmm. I mean, did it seem like the product spec on that bike lent to it being heavier, or do you think it was just a heavier frame?
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, I'm sure it's all of the above. Like it is all those little things, like maybe the tires are 100 grams heavier than they should be and the suspension. I mean, those bikes too, like you said, Evil's a more of a gravity oriented brand. And so they're using linkages and like suspension setups that are much more complicated and maybe are better suited to like the gravity end of things. And so the frame seems overbuilt. And I don't know if that's on purpose or is just a function of like what they need it to do. But yeah, to me, downcountry is certainly about like getting progressive geo and, you know, getting all those things dialed. But the other part of that is still like, it needs to be able to climb. And in my opinion, like climbing performance, a big part of that is how light the bike is. Cause you definitely notice that when you're climbing on a heavy bike.
Yeah, totally. It was interesting seeing the Privateer just came out with their second generations of the 141 and 161. Yeah, I usually bikes, again, this is kind of counterintuitive, the whole conversation, but a big talking point for the evolution of mountain bikes is for them to at least like shed some weight on the next generation. And both these bikes got substantially heavier to where the 161 factory builds are 39, 40 pounds, like maybe 40 pounds.
Whoa.
And the 141, which is a trail bike, is I think 37 ish. Just it's a tank of a bike. And to Travis Real, one of our contributors wrote a piece about warranties. I forget when it was, a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And that could also be one of the points to making bikes heavier is in the case of like Privateer, who I'm sure they have a good warranty, but with their brand ethos being kind of like these simple indestructible bikes that independent athletes can take out and abuse without any concerns. Yeah, that could also be a huge factor in the addition of weight is making things more durable so that frame warranties are not as much of an issue.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That's one of the things that a number of readers pointed out when we published an opinion piece about bike weights recently. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people pointed to the fact that bike warranties could be driving this in terms of like wanting to make sure that the bikes are durable enough. They're not going to have a lot of broken frames. What's interesting though is like you haven't seen when brands do provide like a maximum rider weight for bikes, like I don't know. I haven't seen those creeping up. Again, I haven't looked at the data, but like a lot of the bikes you look at, it's still like really only 200-pound riders can ride this. Like,
right.
You know, they already seem to be very conservative in terms of that. And these bikes, they may be stronger, but they're not like updating that kind of rider spec.
Yeah, totally. Yep. I mean, 200 pounds is not terribly heavy, at least in the United States.
Yeah. All right. And with your riding gear and I mean, there's a lot of factors. Yeah. And then like you're saying though, too, the other end of that is just people are riding harder and courses are harder. And so, I mean, the bikes, they do have to get stronger and, you know, there are laws of physics in terms of like making something stronger. 9 times out of 10, it's going to have to get heavier unless we come up with like new materials or things like that.
Yeah, totally.
So obviously there are advantages to a lighter weight bike. It's going to climb better. It's easier to jump in the air, at least for me, when a bike weighs less, because I can pick it up easier. But are there advantages to heavier bikes? I mean, downhill perhaps?
Yeah, I think so. I remember demoing a bike in Fruta. This is probably 2014, 2015. Actually, as a pivot, I'll just say it. It was a might have been an older Mach 4, and with pivots being just they're great bikes. Many of my favorite bikes are pivots, but and this is also like 10 years ago. But the one thing I remember was coming downhill from Horse Thief Bench on this bike, and it's kind of like that. It's almost like a service road down to the trailhead to where it's just rocky and droppy and loose and wide open. And picking up some speed on that bike and just feeling almost unnerved at how stiff and how light the bike was and getting kind of like tossed around by the trail.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest disadvantage to having a bike that's really light is that, you know, when you're on a 36-pound Privateer or Canfield or some big burly aluminum enduro bike, that added weight is really nice and just making it feel extra planted and stable and composed on really, really technical terrain. And like you experienced when you get really extreme weights, like with an e-bike, an enduro e-bike that's like 45, 50 pounds, like those things are like plows, you know, you can, I know, hopefully you've got tire inserts or something, you know, good air pressure in your tires. Cause if you do, you can just haul and keep your speed and they just feel so stable and planted.
Yeah.
I would say that's the biggest advantage of extra weight.
Yeah. Yeah. Heavier bikes, they definitely stay more planted. You know, I mean, some of that you can tune in terms of the suspension and your tires and tire pressure, you know, cause you don't want to be bounced all over the place and sticking to the ground, especially in downhill racing. That's the faster way to go. Like you really don't want to be in the air any more than you have to. And another thing that I found riding, I was surprised really at what a difference a heavy bike makes was when bike packing and having, you know, just my normal bike, but adding, you know, 20 to 30 extra pounds to it and then going down a hill and realizing like, whoa, I can go way faster with this just purely based on the like potential energy of having that extra weight at the top of the hill. And like, I remember, I mean, for one, you realize you need stronger brakes when you have all that extra weight, because you are going to be going fast and you've got more of a mass that you need to slow down. But yeah, I remember just, I remember loving it and being like, oh, yeah, this is what it's like to, you know, really go fast on this bike. And, you know, normally I could do a descent with my hands off the brakes and, you know, I might get up to 20, but with that loaded bike, I was pushing 25 or 30, which is a huge difference.
Right. I remember experiencing that too, a couple summers ago, bike packing off of Roland's Pass, just like a big high altitude mountain pass in Colorado. And then having like loaded bike bags and this, you know, the saddle bag, and everything. And it just feeling like an absolute bus and just like plowing over rocks and, everything. And yeah, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think that like e-bikes are driving this to some degree where, you know, for if you have an e-bike, obviously it's providing some of the power. And so it seems like maybe a heavier weight is less of a concern because you're like, oh, well, like the bike is going to carry that for me. Do you think that drives some of it, even for non-electric bikes?
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of funny because now there's like, it's like there's two classes of class one e-bikes. There's like the 35 to 40 pound e-bikes where people want it to look and feel like a regular old trail bike. And weight's kind of a big issue, especially because it's got a smaller motor, smaller battery, and range becomes a concern. And then there's, you know, those like 45 to 50 pound e-bikes where it's just like, it's got all the travel. It's got a regular full-size motor, full-size, what, 630 watt hour battery or whatever it is. And, the range and everything, range, weight, all that is just not as much of a concern. On those bikes, it seems like, yeah, they're just throwing, like Rocky Mountain, for example, a lot of their, I think, what do they call it? The Instinct Power Play comes stock with tire inserts and, Fox 38, I believe, all that stuff, you know, everything that, if weight weren't an issue, then you would have it.
Yeah.
But then on the lighter e-bikes, it's like, yeah, just kind of regular, maybe enduro or trail rated components. Yeah. It's kind of a funny division for e-bikes right now.
Yeah, definitely. And it, I mean, maybe it's telling too that the first electric mountain bikes were these like bigger battery, heavy bikes, you know, much more travel, and they were sort of, you know, like self shuttle oriented bikes. But then we got the lighter ones, and clearly that's, you know, part of that's the technology maybe didn't exist initially to make these bikes lighter, but clearly there was a demand too that, you know, we had these heavy bikes, but somebody somewhere was saying, these are a little too heavy. Like, I think it would be more fun if we had a lightweight version of this. So yeah, I guess there is hope that we will continue to see like lighter weight options for riders who prefer that.
I think the demand is being incognito on a lightweight e-bike.
Yeah, it's got to be quiet and it's got to look like a regular bike. Yeah, for sure.
Which I have heard at least one instance of a group of friends that had a friend that was riding one of these and nobody knew for like months and finally figured it out.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah. I have a friend that I try to, he hates e-bikes. And so, yeah, I try to like, see if I can trick him, and yeah, haven't been successful yet, but I think I just haven't had the right bike.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think we're in agreement, and most mountain bikers would be in agreement that, you know, today's bikes are way more capable than they were back when I had my tall boy in 2012. You know, we've added a lot of features. We've added performance. The bikes are more durable. But at this point, do you think that it will be possible to start losing weight again? Like, should it be possible for us to have everything we have now, but maybe have lighter bikes?
I think so. I think, yeah. And also, I think you had an article or opinion about this, about it's time for bikes to lose some weight. But I think there is definitely some wiggle room for mountain bikes to shed at least a little bit of weight. Yeah, I don't think the majority of them are too heavy right now. Hmm. And that's not to say that they haven't gained a lot of weight, like as an entire category over the past several years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering if, like, is it even possible that one day we would have a highly capable bike that only weighs 25 pounds? And right now, that would be very difficult to do. But it's not, to me too, you know, my question was going to be like, how could we do this? And I guess if either of us had an answer, like we'd have a bike company and we'd be like making lots of money right now. But yeah, I mean, one of the developments that we saw actually just this week was the new Yeti cross-country bike, which, you know, it's a cross-country bike and it's very expensive. They've done basically everything they can to keep this bike mm-hmm. weight under, I think, under 23 pounds for a full suspension bike, which is very impressive. But yeah, they're having to do things like get rid of mechanical drivetrains on the highest end builds and, you know, relying on wireless where, I mean, gosh, that can't save that much weight. I mean, you're talking about like, you know, a meter of cable and housing and like, you know, a couple of stops on the frame. But yeah, so to me, there isn't anything obvious, but I guess I'm also hopeful that there's going to be some breakthrough where we like discover something lighter than carbon fiber or, yeah, I don't know.
Right. Yeah. Well, not to mention that the transmission derailleurs are, all of them are basically heavier than any derailleur hanger, SRAM mm-hmm. derailleur.
Yeah. Mechanical ones. Yep.
Which again, to make it more robust, I think they also added a lot of material mm-hmm. and weight. But yeah, I'd go on, at least in my opinion, I go on to the point of like having the right weight for the right bike. 25 pounds mm-hmm. is probably a great weight for 100 to 120 mil travel bike. At least in my opinion, for like 120 mil travel bike, I'd want something probably in the 28 to 30 pound range. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, part of that too, right? It is about what is the bike for, but it's also about like the rider, right? Like, especially with yeah. high school athletes, like, I mean, a lot of these kids, they weigh less than 100 pounds. And like,
right.
gosh, I have a friend looking for a bike for his kid who's like 10 years old or no, he may be like 8 years old. And, you know, you look at bikes from the big brands and those weigh almost 30 pounds for like a little kid.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, and not to mention like adults who are short or women or like whoever. Yeah. I don't think it's just about what the bike does. I think there's a wider variety of people that we're trying to fit now too. And that seems tough.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It will be interesting to see where that goes and how you can do it. Cause yeah, honestly, it does not seem easy to do because otherwise I guess it would have been done.
Yeah. And I think there's also several parts where we don't want to accept weight reduction from like namely in tires. Mm-hmm. I don't think many of us would be willing to take lighter tires over the chance or risk that we're going to experience more flats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm waiting for those airless tires. I'm waiting for the airless ones that you don't even have to worry.
No. Like,
if they're lightweight.
They're never going to be good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a shame. There's got to be some foam that we haven't invented yet.
Right. Some kind of foam we can put in our tire, in between our tire and rim. And
yeah. Yeah. Or just like, yeah, glue some tread onto some foam and just roll with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And I think it's cool too. I mean, maybe we'll see some developments that come out of gravel bikes because this is kind of where mountain bikes and road bikes come together. And obviously road bikes, they've been working on getting lightweight for decades and they've done mm-hmm. a pretty good job at that. I mean, it's not uncommon to see road bikes in the weights in the teens in terms of pounds. And so, yeah, like a lot of the developments for durable tires that you can put on a road bike or a gravel bike mm-hmm. that don't add a lot of weight. I know there's definitely a lot of effort behind doing that. And so, yeah, maybe we'll see we'll see some trickle over from that. You know, we'll see the bikes getting heavier from the e-bike side, but we'll see them maybe getting a little bit lighter from the gravel side.
One of the pieces of frame technology that has gotten really, really popular over the past couple of years, and I think it was first done by Specialized, is the concept of flex stays. Mm. And that's been applied on a lot of cross-country or lighter weight trail bikes these days, and just mm-hmm. getting rid of the extra hardware and pivots that would make a horse link, and just doing essentially a single pivot with more flexy chainstays.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. We are seeing a lot more of that. And from the folks we've talked to too, a lot of them seem to think that because our shocks are so much better today, have much better technology and performance, for sure, that we're able to simplify the linkages a little bit. In the past, the linkage was trying to do a lot of the work that the shock can now do by itself. So yeah, that is an area where I wouldn't be surprised if we saw some pretty significant weight savings.
Yeah, totally.
Well, cool. This has been a fun conversation about bike weight. I don't think we've solved anything or learned anything new necessarily, but we definitely have a good, I have a much better perspective of like where we are and like the tension that there is between this idea of like making our bikes more capable, but also trying to keep them lightweight. As always, it's been a pleasure to chat. Matt, we always appreciate your insights and wish you the best in the future.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Jeff. Again, it's been an unreal experience just being with single tracks. And I'm looking forward to riding more for y'all in the future. I'll definitely miss it.
Yeah, thanks. Well, that's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week.